from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum this morning, today marks the day that the annual Goldman Environmental Awards will officially be presented later this afternoon in San Francisco. Two of the recipients will join us in each of the half hours ahead to tell their stories and how they came to win their coveted awards. Hilton Kelly, representing the United States, leading the battle for environmental justice on the Texas Gulf Coast. He fights for communities living in the shadow of polluting industries. And Raoul Dutoit, who coordinated conservation initiatives that helped develop and maintain the largest remaining black rhino populations in Zimbabwe. Forum is up ahead. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum Second Hour. Each year in San Francisco, the San Francisco-based Goldman Foundation awards six grassroots environmentalists from six different continents a $150,000 cash prize for grassroots environmental activism. In fact, this award is known as the Green Nobel Prize. And we're going to speak this hour to two of this year's six recipients who have done some extraordinary work. The first we're going to meet, in fact, is Hilton Kelly, who is an environmental activist dedicated to protecting his hometown of Port Arthur, Texas, from petrochemical and hazardous waste pollution. And we should mention that he spent a good deal of time living in Oakland. He, for a while, was pursuing a career on the silver screen as a would-be actor and stuntman, but went back to his home in Port Arthur. And we're going to say, at least initially, about what he did there. As I said to him before we went on the air, it was really a kind of prodigious research project to find out about PCBs and to find out about toxics. He could have almost gotten himself a PhD dissertation in terms of what he was able to learn and glean. But beyond that, he was able to really bring things to action. And let's hear Robert Redford actually narrating from the documentary, the 2011 winners, what he had to say about Hilton Kelly.
Activist Hilton Kelly's hometown is on the fence line of eight separate petrochemical facilities, including Shell Motiva.
Well, I was born and raised in Port Arthur, Texas, on the west side of town, right next to the refineries. And when I was growing up in this community, you always have a sense that, you know, you're not going to go anywhere, you can't achieve anything. I left Port Arthur, Texas with dreams of becoming an actor and a stuntman in Hollywood.
During the 20 years Hilton was in California, his Gulf Coast community suffered a steep decline from economic and environmental damage.
And I was just so set back by the dilapidated situation of downtown. And I found that a lot of people were ill, usually it's cancer-related. And there was a large number of kids here with respiratory problems.
Hilton Kelly with us in studio. Congratulations for being one of the six recipients of the coveted Goldman Environmental Prize. Glad to have you here.
Thank you very much. I'm honored to be here.
Well, it's an honor to have you here. And I must say that when you took on Motiva, the Shell subsidiary, and led this fight, negotiating improvements and actually winning benefits for the community, it was they wanted to build the largest refinery in the nation.
Yes, as a matter of fact, the Motiva / Shell oil refinery at present, they're putting out 285,000 barrels of oil per day. By the time the expansion is done that they're presently working on, they're going to be putting out 625,000 barrels of oil per day. It's going to be the largest oil refinery in the country, the second largest in the world.
But as we heard in that little brief element that we heard from narrated by Robert Redford, we're talking about eight separate petrochemical companies in the city of Port Arthur.
This is correct. Yes. I mean, we are disproportionately being impacted by all of these refineries and chemical plants in our community. As a matter of fact, Port Arthur Westside community is predominantly low-income African-American and living at or below the poverty line. And one of the reasons why we feel that this is such an attractive area for the petrochemical industry and incinerator facilities is because it's the area of least resistance. When I went back home to Port Arthur in 2000 just to go to the Mardi Gras, and have a good time, then come back to California. I just decided to take a little tour of Port Arthur, and I found that the situation was very, very bleak. There was abandoned buildings. There was blight everywhere. A lot of the kids were ill. Many people were dying from cancer. And
many unemployed young people.
And many, many unemployed. We have 15.5% unemployment. And yet, you know, the community is located, when I mean directly on the fence line of a $40 to $50 billion a year company, this is exactly what I mean. We're literally on the fence line. So I decided to go back to Port Arthur to do what I could because no one was doing anything. And I was waiting for someone to step up to the plate. But yet I would call home periodically and check in. And so I wanted to make a difference.
You looked in the mirror and said, if nobody else is doing it, I'm going to do it.
Hey, you know, I couldn't really talk about what nobody else was doing. I'm from Port Arthur, and I decided, why don't you go back home and make a difference? And that's what I did that same year, May of 2000, to be exact.
But also did a lot of investigative research and found out about cancer and respiratory problems.
Yes, this is correct. I worked very closely with a gentleman by the name of Reverend Roy Malvo, who had been doing some environmental work in
Any
Beaumont,
relation
Texas.
To Julianne Malvo?
No, I don't think he is. No, Reverend Roy Malvo is a Baptist preacher there in Southeast Texas, and he was very educated on some of the contaminants that were being released from the plants. And Reverend Roy Malvo introduced me to Denny Larson with Global Community Monitoring. And as a matter of fact,
he's been on this program.
Yes, GCM is located right here in the Bay Area. And it's ironic that I had just left the Bay Area and moved back to Port Arthur. And here I meet this gentleman, Mr. Denny Larson, who is over the Global Community Monitoring. And they introduced us to the bucket, which is a grab sample device. We could take air samples with it and send the samples into the lab. But GCM did a lot of work with our organization and helped us to understand how we could use those samples. But yet, you know, we took it up on ourselves to go ahead and follow the lead, and we started taking air samples and sending those samples in to get them tested. And what we found was that there was a large amount of toxins in the environment that should not have been there.
We're talking about some pretty serious toxins, too, aren't we? We're talking about dioxin and furan. And what was the result, though, of your push with Shell? I mean, what eventually did it result in terms of benefits for or ways of ensuring greater protection or safety?
Well, by proving our case by using the air monitors, we proved to Shell that we knew that emissions were being dumped that were illegal. There are legal and illegal emissions whenever they exceed their cap. And each year, those refineries, not only Shell, but others in the area as well, dump tons and tons of illegal emissions into the environment, the air that we breathe and the water that we drink. So the results after getting into litigation, they decided that they wanted to sit down and talk with us. And we were able to put together a good neighbor agreement that the Motiva Oil Refinery was willing to take a look at and ultimately sign and agree to some things they would do in the community. A few of the things we were asking for was a reduction in emissions by putting in sulfur recovery units, by putting in flare gas recovery units. And we also asked for some funding to help start businesses in the low-income area because it's been basically barren of any services, community centers, and what have you for years because many businesses do not want to locate in that area because of the amount of pollution in the area.
Now, there was a video of you standing with a lot of young black men largely talking about how desolate, I mean it's the video is clear, it's pretty blighted, as you said,
yes.
But actually doing some condominium development and getting these young men to work.
That is correct. Now that we've been successful in getting the Shell / Motiva oil refinery to play a part in the revitalization and the cleanup and the reduction of emissions in our community, other industries are like Valero. They're jumping in, and they're wanting to do the same thing because we've been talking to them and educating them on why they should do it. But yet they understand that we're very serious and that we were not going to back off and that we were not going to take no for an answer. So now we're sitting at the table. We're looking at ways in which we can work together to get rid of the almost 70-year-old housing project where I was born because it has a lot of issues, and not to mention the fact that it's located right on the fence line. And people living in the housing project don't have much of a voice, and we owe it to them to protect them and to get them out of harm's way.
Talking again with Hilton Kelly, environmental activist dedicated to protecting his hometown of Port Arthur, Texas, from petrochemical and hazardous waste pollution, and a 2011 Goldman Environmental Prize recipient for North America. The recipients represent different continents. And this is almost representative in some ways, the work that you've done, of what is classically called fighting against environmental racism.
Basically, that's what it is, because we've found that over the years, not only in Port Arthur, Texas, but in other communities very much like Port Arthur, in Narco, Louisiana, and Lake Charles, Louisiana, predominantly African-American communities are being bombarded with companies that want to bring toxic waste to burn or polluting industries right into their communities to do business, because it's the area of least resistance. And I think it's unfair to dump on citizens simply because they don't have the will or the voice to fight for themselves.
You're fighting an incineration process, too, here, when we're talking about PCBs, aren't you?
That's correct. Yeah, the Veolia Incinerator Facility is a company that's owned by the French, and it was located here in the United States some years ago. And they were petitioning the Environmental Protection Agency to circumvent some of the federal laws that prohibit the importation of toxic waste from other countries for incineration. And yet the EPA under the Bush administration was really looking to assist them in actually achieving that. But we stepped up. We fought to get it stopped. And we stopped 20,000 tons of PCBs from being brought into the United States for incineration, and ultimately protecting the health and welfare of the citizens in Port Arthur and other parts of the country, because as we know, emissions just don't stay in one area. It flies. It moves.
Again, we're talking with Hilton Kelly. I'm going to give out the phone number, and you may want to join our conversation. You may want to respond to the story you've heard about the really exceptional work that Hilton Kelly has provided leadership for in terms of, well, as I said, fighting environmental racism and protecting his hometown of Port Arthur, which has come under some serious kind of hazes and toxicity as a result of the petrochemical and hazardous waste pollution industries. Our toll-free number is available to you, and we do welcome your phone calls. It's 866-733-6786. It's a half-hour segment. We're going to meet another Goldman Environmental Prize winner in the second half hour. So if you'd like to talk to Hilton Kelly, feel free to join us now. Now would be the time to call, 866-733-6786. You can also, of course, send us an email. Our email address is simply forum@kqed.org, or you can post a question or comment on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. And I believe our first caller is none other than Denny Larson, who's already been mentioned here. Denny, welcome.
Good morning, Michael, and congratulations again, Hilton. What an inspirational victory for fence line communities around the world.
Well, thank you, Danny. I really appreciate that.
Well, you know, together, working together with you has been an extreme pleasure over the years and will continue to be. I just wanted to let your listeners know, too, and I sent you the link last night, that Hilton is not just sitting on his laurels. We've picked a fight with the refineries down there because they won't support a toxic warning siren. As you know, we have that here, Michael. But down in Port Arthur, the same company, Shell and Chevron, don't think that people deserve a warning siren. They want to just use these ring-down systems. So he's not resting on his laurels. He's picked up his prize, and we're going right back after him together.
Talk about your work with Hilton Kelly specifically, if you could, Denny.
Sure, sure. Well, I first met Hilton in a Baptist church of Reverend Malvo back in 2000. He came to a bucket brigade training, and we helped set up Hilton and his group, the Community and Power and Development Association, with their own air sampling buckets, the funding to be able to pay for the testing, and then the ongoing training on how to, you know, take those results, very scientific stuff, as you alluded to, Michael, and learn how to put that in plain English. Hilton was able to go out and start, you know, organizing his neighbors and educating them to get them to speak out. I mean, even in a place like Port Arthur, just getting people to stand up and speak out about what they're experiencing is a struggle that Hilton could talk to you for hours about. But beyond that, you know, then we helped Hilton bring in other national organizations on these upset pollution issues to publish reports about it. And ultimately, in the Shell Motiva case, since we've done so many good neighbor agreements out here, helped him to do that with Shell. And, you know, just continue to build his capacity. The exceptional thing about Hilton is how quickly he learns, and his capacity and his organization's capacity is built to take on yet the next level of this sort of environmental justice campaign. And there just isn't any better example of how we try to do our work to empower people than what Hilton has done on his own to pick that up and just run with it and grow with it in an incredible way.
Let's talk about that for a moment, Hilton Kelly, because it is so inspiring. I mean, how did you get people worked up? You're talking about their children and their future. I mean, that's clear. I mean, that certainly inspires them to become activists. But you had a lot of success just galvanizing in a grassroots way. And talk about what you did and how you did it.
Well, first of all, I mean, I was born and raised in Port Arthur, Texas, so I have a love for Port Arthur, Texas like none other. And I've always enjoyed, you know, living there when I was growing up there, and my friends and relatives there, we were a pretty close-knit community. And I, you know,
so you had roots, obviously.
I have roots there, yeah. Definitely, and that was my passion. I wanted to do
well, it made you more credible, too, as a leader.
Right? Yes, yes. And when I went back home, a lot of folks was wondering. They said, well, why did you come back home? You're living in California. You're in the acting business. What made you come back? I said, well, you know, because I love you guys. I care about this community, and I want to do something to change the conditions here, economically speaking and environmentally speaking. I said, you know, I have some knowledge of what you're being exposed to. And so I just started my campaign really by educating people on the importance of voting. I started there, first of all. And then I started holding meetings at St. John Missionary Baptist Church in Port Arthur. And I started educating people on what they were being exposed to when it came to environmental toxins. And I also helped them understand how their kids were being impacted.
So the church became a very important part of this in terms of getting people into action. You
know? Most definitely.
Central.
That's right. Well, in the southern communities, church has always been central in our
central
community.
Central to the civil rights movement.
That's exactly right. And when Martin Luther King was alive and protest and organizing, the church was the center focus of his meetings, and that's where people would congregate. And it didn't change for me either, so I'm very happy to have followed in that particular technique. But at the same time, you know, I just wanted to make a difference, and I was very happy when I did meet Mr. Denny Larson with the Global Community Monitoring. He came and he said, well, Hilton, with the work that you're doing, and the information that you're trying to bring forward, we have this device called the bucket that you could use to help gather the data or the samples, and you can have it tested. So we were really excited about that. And he educated me on how it worked, and we used it, and we were able to bring our issue to focus and prove that we had some issues with environmental pollution well above what even EPA would allow to be released into the environment.
Denny, before we say goodbye to you and bring in some of our other callers, you want to add something about, again,
well, I just want to let
grassroots activism?
How difficult it was to get into those churches, because a lot of them, you know, the refineries are going around offering to pave their parking lot and this, that, and the other thing. And it was just incredible how persistent Hilton was every time that we held a meeting and only two people showed up or the churches turned their back to us. He just kept going back until he found a church that he could find a home in and he could get people to come to the meetings. And that just went on for so long. He persisted that it's just an incredible, inspirational story.
Well, Denny,
thanks
good of
again.
You to call in and join us. Appreciate it. Thank you. And let's bring some other callers in. Kate, you're on the air. Good morning.
Yes, hi, and good morning. I wanted to ask Hilton, since he grew up there and is a member of the community, if he could just talk about other efforts he's making to build the community, you know, in terms of culture and jobs and places for people to gather. How is that? How is your work contributing to that?
We're making some great progress in that particular area. As a matter of fact, under the Lisa Jackson administration, Lisa Jackson is the head of the Environmental Protection Agency. She was appointed by Barack Obama. She set up a program called the EPA Showcase Community Program, and the United States are divided in 10 regions. Port Arthur, Texas is in Region 6. And Port Arthur, Texas was selected as the EPA Showcase Community. And what this basically means is that we're going to have direct resources that we're going to have access to when it comes to home development, community development, and emission reduction programs. The funding can be used to build houses, also to help create jobs and businesses in the area. In West Port Arthur, Texas, we have no community centers whatsoever. We don't have any grocery stores. And there's over 3,000 to 4,000 people living in that community. And we have to go about 4 to 5 miles just to go shopping at a grocery store. So we are making some great progress when it comes to getting our city to start being more proactive and looking at ways in which housing or the HUD can play a role in redeveloping that community.
And we thank Kate for the call. You think about possibility of running for political office?
That's an interesting question. I'm asked that question quite frequently. I had a couple of folks that were willing to nominate me and start to push and help to build a campaign for me. But at this particular time, I think that we're just starting to get some real traction when it comes to environmental cleanup. And I'm just not ready to leave that post at this particular time. But when that time comes within the next 2 to 3 years, I believe, I will be running for some type of public office.
Seems like a natural to me. And Tim, join us. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hi. I'm finishing up law school right now as studying environmental law. And I was curious if you guys employed much litigation strategy in this struggle. I used to be a teacher working in low-income communities, and I'm wondering the relative effectiveness of different methods of combating environmental racism and just overall pollution.
Yeah, we talked about grassroots activism. Let's talk about litigation and how you went forward with that and different levels of litigation. Good question. Thanks for that, too.
Well, yes, as a matter of fact, we do employ litigation. As a matter of fact, we work with a gentleman by the name of Jim Blackburn out of Houston, Texas. And Jim Blackburn is a toxic torque lawyer, and he worked pro bono. Unfortunately, we really couldn't pay him the kind of money that, you know, he usually require. But he was very interested in the case. He took it on, and he was instrumental in helping us also to achieve getting that good neighbor agreement signed. And also we're working with Kelly Harrigan. Kelly Harrigan is in Austin, Texas, at the UT Law Clinic. And she works pro bono as well, and she was very instrumental in helping us to have many of the successes that we've had. She's a very persistent attorney, and she does not take no for an answer, and she does her homework. So
you've been a magnet for some pretty good people, haven't you?
Well, I think so. I mean, I think that people see that, you know, I'm very committed to the cause. I'm not a quitter. And I was dedicated to getting my community cleaned up, and not only the Port Arthur Westside community, but we work with other communities along the Gulf Coast, like in Louisiana, all the way into Florida. And I'm very happy to have a great resource of folks that I can turn to, like GCM, the EIP, Environmental Integrity Project, and also Jim Blackburn, our attorney, and Kelly Harrigan. I mean, we just have a great amount of resources, and it didn't start off that way, but I think that people saw that I needed a hand, and they said this guy is on to something, and they decided to reach out to do what they could.
Quick question from a listener named Robin. Is there a problem with water contamination in the area? As I recall, but I could be wrong, is there not a hazardous waste injection well in Port Arthur?
Well, as a matter of fact, you're absolutely right. We have underground injection that takes place in the Port Arthur area. We have a lot of salt cabins. Industries inject tons and tons of toxic waste underground. And from their perspective, they seem to think that the lining that they put inside these salt cabins are sufficient. But yes, we do have some trouble with our underground drinking water. But yet, there are many issues to be dealt with.
You
have
many more fights ahead of you, don't you?
We have many, many more fights, and it's not going to end yet.
So what are you going to do with $150,000?
$150,000. Well, you know, in the whole scheme of things, it sounds like a lot of money, and it really is a lot of money. But once you chop it up, we're gonna use $50,000 of that money to put back into our campaign and our fight. I believe I'm going to take $50,000 of that and put it aside for retirement. I'm kind of getting up there in age now. And, of course, Uncle Sam has to get his cut. And we're going to use a little bit to fix up our house.
Well, congratulations once again, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Hilton Kelly, one of the new Goldman Environmental recipients representing the continent of North America. We're going to meet another one after our break. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. And again, we're going to meet another Goldman Environmental Award winner because that's what we have decided to do this hour, meet a couple of them. There are six awards that are given for grassroots environmentalism from six different continents. And the award is $150,000 in cash. And certainly, it's a big award. In fact, it gets international recognition because it is, well, as I said earlier, the Green Nobel Prize for grassroots and environmental activism. And we're going to hear this hour from a second winner who won for Africa, René Dutoit, who is a Zimbabwean, and he's a wildlife conservationist who has really fought a pretty important and good fight to save the critically endangered black rhinoceros population from extinction. And let me just say by way of introduction that in Zambia, all of the rhinoceroses were poached in 1992. And so there became a movement because they want the rhino horns. They want them in Asia, and they want them in Asia for medicinal reasons, or what they believe are medicinal reasons. They want them in the Middle East for daggers. And the result is they're cutting off the horns. And I'll tell you, if you love rhinoceroses, as I do, and you see this horn cut off, it's a pretty awful thing to say. But I'll stop editorializing here. The important thing for you to know is that there was a border that's been crossed, and there's a lot of money behind it to poach in Zimbabwe. And what René Dutoit did was move essentially thousands of these rhinoceroses away to hundreds of miles away. And it's a lot of sweat and blood in moving rhinoceroses. It's not an easy thing to do. Let's hear, in fact, from a cut from the official Goldman Prize documentary featuring this year's winners and again narrated by Robert Redford.
By 1992, the entire rhinoceros population in Zambia had been poached. Raoul Dutoit was horrified as bands of poachers began to cross the border to his native Zimbabwe to slaughter the animals for their horns. Raoul proposed moving the endangered rhinos hundreds of miles away from the Zambian border to save habitats in southern Zimbabwe's low-veld region.
We moved, I think it's a total of 111 rhinos, black rhinos, into the low veld, and they built up to four times that number. When we started that, this low veld had 4% of Zimbabwe's rhinos, and it's now got 80% of Zimbabwe's rhinos.
Again, that's a cut from the Goldman Prize documentary that features this year's winners, and the winner who is with us in studio is René Dutoit. Congratulations. Delighted to have you with us.
Thanks very much, Michael. I'm delighted to be here.
And kudos for all that you've done, which is pretty remarkable. We heard that airplane in the cut, and that's important because there's a lot of money now. It's coming from Asia, a lot of money, a lot of new technology behind the poachers, and a lot of pretty sophisticated stuff.
Indeed. That aircraft is our aircraft, and we use a combination of high technology, aircraft, radio tracking, modern transponder devices to help us in our fight against the poachers. They, in turn, are well-armed. They have automatic weapons, ex-military weapons. They have sport hunting rifles. They have, you know, for Africa, what would be regarded as means, vehicles, cell phones, all the things that essentially are required by people acting as bank robbers. These are not local people. They're not from local communities. They are specialized in rhino poaching, and we have to fight them with everything we can.
You've got the fourth largest population of black rhinos in Zimbabwe?
That's correct. Zimbabwe is the fourth largest range state after South Africa, Namibia, and Kenya.
And we should mention that all species are under threat. This is the only one that's not on the verge of extinction, but black rhinos are in terrible decline.
Let me just correct that. We've got two species of rhinos in Africa, white rhinos and black rhinos.
Yes.
The white rhinos number somewhere around 20,000, so they're classified as vulnerable. But the black rhinos are there's only 4,800 in the world, so they are
endangered.
Endangered.
Seriously endangered. And the fact of the matter is that these poachers, as I said, are well-funded because there's such a demand for these horns. What about dehorning them? Has that been put into action more?
We do dehorn. I mean, a rhino horn is like your fingernails. It's just a kind of a gratinized hair-like substance that has got no nerves in it, and you can cut those horns off. The problem is that the very high value of rhino horn means that the residual horn stump that's left behind, because we can't cut it off totally, otherwise you'd end up with a situation a bit like pulling out the nail bed of your nail. You know, there's a germinal layer in the horn that we can't interfere with. But what's left behind, therefore, has still got a value. And we see poaching as a balance between reward and risk. A poacher comes to obtain a certain reward in the face of a certain risk. Dehorning can reduce the reward to some extent, but you still have to maintain the risk because, you know, if the reward is low but the risk is also low, the poachers will still come and shoot those rhinos. So we dehorn kind of selectively and strategically. It's not a blanket solution. We don't have the money to dehorn every rhino, given as well that the horns regrow. Within a couple of years, that horn has regrown fully anyway, so you'd have to keep doing it. It's not a blanket solution.
It's major profit, though, in this business of poaching, isn't there?
Indeed, and the problem really is that there's an increased Asian footprint in Africa. We've got people now living in the capital cities in Africa buying the horn, whereas previously that horn went through a long supply channel. You mentioned the poaching in Zambia, the cross-border poaching into Zimbabwe. That horn went via very circuitous routes to Asia, and the prices that were paid for the horn along that chain obviously stepped up as you went along the chain. But now those in-market prices are getting paid much closer to home, and therefore the price has gone up by tenfold.
If you'd like to join us, by the way, in this conversation with René Dutoit, you're cordially invited to do that if you have questions or comments. Again, he's one of the environmental award winners of the Goldman Environmental Prize, and our toll-free number is available to you, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. It's 866-733-6786. We do welcome your calls. If you have something you'd like to say or you'd like to ask, please feel free to join us now. It's 866-733-6786. You can also, of course, join us by email. Our email address, forum@kqed.org, or you can post a question or comment on our website simply by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment. You've moved so many rhinos, and as I said in my introduction, these are not easy creatures to move.
To be absolutely honest, yes, rhino translocation is a specialized skill, but we've learned how to do it. That's not so much the problem. There are a lot of other problems, like where do you move them to? How are you going to create enough space, enough security in those areas? Actually picking up the rhino, putting it in a box, moving it, that's for us not such a big deal.
Really, ABC?
Yeah, indeed, it's down to a pretty slick art. We have a very, very low mortality rate, a low loss of losing these rhinos in translocation, and we've been doing it for a number of years. Not just us. I mean, there's a lot of wildlife management done in South Africa, Namibia, Kenya. I mean, new techniques all the time. Just last year, they were moving rhinos with helicopters in Namibia by stinging them, literally putting slings around the animal's legs and lifting them up with a helicopter so the rhino's dangling underneath a helicopter and moving it like that. So it's a big business, but people know how to do it.
What sort of response have you had from the Mugabe government in Zimbabwe? I mean, have they been supportive, neutral, created obstacles? Have they arrested these poachers as much as they could or should?
It's varied. Zimbabwe has had economic collapse, and under those situations, the government agencies, firstly, have got reduced resources to operate with, and secondly, some of the officials are prone to corruption, as they would in any society anywhere in the world where you're not getting paid enough. But we do have some dedicated officials that we work with. They do still try. We've got a mixed situation where we have had a number of poachers arrested. Sometimes the sentences that have been meted out by the courts have been totally inadequate. In other cases, we've had some determined action against them. It's been very variable. Our biggest problem has been under the current political program in the country. There's a resettlement program which has allowed a lot of people to move in, small-scale farmers, subsistence farmers, into areas that were former wildlife areas, and that's created a problem of habitat loss and made the protection of these animals far more complicated.
The poachers, as we've indicated, are pretty well-armed and well-organized and well-funded. South Africa particularly seems to be cited as at least a place where some of this is emanating from, some of the money and so forth.
Indeed. The problem in South Africa is that there's been a flare-up of illegal activity there, which actually started in semi-legal hunting of rhinos. I mentioned earlier that there are a number of white rhinos in Africa, over 20,000, and it is actually legally permissible in terms of international wildlife trade controls to have white rhinos safari hunted by clients from the US, Europe, and so on. But what started happening is Vietnamese hunters were coming out. I would put hunters in inverted commas because they weren't real safari hunters. They were paying for these hunts, but then taking the horn to sell it back in Vietnam. And that stimulated then a resurgence of demand, and that has flared up and created now a poaching problem for us.
It's really like shark fins, isn't it, in some ways? Huh?
In many ways, it's just a very, very sad situation where people who are remote from these magnificent animals are wanting those products for various reasons and are too distant from the actual wildlife to appreciate the damage that they're doing through that demand.
Now, let's talk about some of those reasons, as because they're difficult to understand. I mean, many of them have no basis in medical fact. They're kind of folklore almost, aren't they, as far as the medical reasons?
The problem, Michael, is that's irrelevant. Yes, there is no medicinal basis in Western terms for rhino horn as a component of traditional Chinese medicine.
It's not going to cure impotency, as some believe, or something like that.
Well, actually, to be absolutely honest there, the story that rhino horn is used as an aphrodisiac is incorrect. What it's used for in Asia is mainly as a fever-reducing drug, as a product that will help to purify your blood and so on. That is in traditional Chinese medicine, and that belief has been established over many centuries among many people. It's a cultural belief, and you know, one has to recognize cultures and be a bit careful not to just dismiss this as ignorance. But more recently, we've got a new problem, which is that in Vietnam, there's a recent belief that rhino horn will cure cancer, and that's created a whole new demand over the last few years.
What about the demand for ceremonial daggers in the Middle East? That's also part of rhino horns, isn't it?
It was a big problem. It seems to have abated. The demand from Asia, particularly from Vietnam now, is resulting in very much higher prices being paid for the horn for that end use rather than dagger handle. So while it is still a bit of a concern in Yemen, in the Middle East, it's fundamentally this demand for medicinal application in Asia that's causing the crisis for rhinos.
Let me again remind you that you are free to join us now. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786, or you can send an email to forum@kqed.org. Here's an email from Robert who says, since the rhino horn price is so high and since it regrows, I can't help but wonder if they couldn't ranch the rhinos and sell their horns without harming the animals. I know that they would rather that the horn trade go away, but realistically, is that going to happen? It seems like the profits from humanely selling the horn would pay for a lot of habitat recovery.
It's a very good question, and it's been one that's been under active debate. The issues here are how one would do it in a way that would result in a properly regulated trade in rhino horn. There are recent techniques now to extract DNA from rhino horn, in other words, to look at the molecular DNA composition of rhino horn and trace the horn. That'll help with traceability. But there are many concerns still. I mean, international trade in endangered animals is regulated under an international convention called CITES, Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species. And to work through that trade regulation mechanism to the point that horn could be traded will take a number of years. In the meanwhile, some countries, particularly South Africa, actively looking at this. It is a very, very reasonable question to ask and one that needs to be put on the table and thoroughly explored.
In the meantime, these poachers are killing rhinos. I mean, they're hacking them.
Absolutely.
To death, really, aren't they?
Yeah, we really have to save them in the short term. We can promote various longer-term strategies, but in the short term, we have to fight an immediate battle to save these animals.
And let me go to a caller, and that's Randy. Good morning. Welcome to the program. You're on the air.
I know the name of your guest, and I just started tuning into it. So if I could know his name so I can...
Raoul Dutoit. Raoul Dutoit. It's RAOULDUTOIT.
Well, thank you. I'm a long-time listener and a big patron of KQED and public radio. So I wanted to... I'm familiar with Jane Goodall and her foundation and several other problems with other animals that have been decimated because of some need of aphrodisia or aphrodisiac or whatever. So I'm thinking what Jane Goodall had done was she tackled it from several different areas. She got the indigenous peoples to make money from saving the rhinos or the silverback.
I don't know if Jane Goodall saved rhinos. I think they were mainly chimpanzees.
But, no, yeah. I said them silverback. Did misspeak, but I tried to correct myself and say the silverback.
That's okay.
Gorillas. Yeah. So there'd be a lot of misspeaking, I'm sure. But she attacked it from several areas. She got the indigenous peoples to buy into it, where they had a profit from keeping the poachers out. She had started a foundation where she got money for patrol, more poacher patrol, and, you know, attacked it with a public service or whatever about those people, targeted those people that were wanting to buy it, you know, the buyers, and as that there were other alternatives, and that it was a stigma.
Randy, let me go to the heart of your question, if I may, and just ask Renee Dutoit, what about working with the people in the area and kind of the way she's suggesting that Jane Goodall had?
Indeed. You know, Randy's quite correct. We do have to get to the people on the ground. If we're going to save wild animals and wild places in Africa, we have to have a conducive social context for that. What we're doing with these rhinos, and actually this Goldman Award gives us a fantastic opportunity to develop this new initiative, is we're going to pay production incentives to local communities for every calf that's born. A rhino that is born is a biodiversity asset that's valued by the world. If the world values those animals, they should put their money where their mouth is and pay something back into the area where these rhinos are being produced. And we're going to translate that into direct support for schools. For every rhino that's born, there'll be an incentive paid in the form of material support for schools. These schools have got no teaching materials. Some of them don't even have roofs. We will put direct support in. In return, though, we will require those communities to demonstrate that they are conducting awareness programs, they're assisting in the information that we need on poaching incursions and so on. So we'll try and make it a win-win situation.
How do you monitor that?
Monitor the extent to which the community is helping us.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there's amazing uptake already. You may have heard when this program, my segment of the program started, there were some school children singing a beautiful song. That was just a little group of school kids in a local school. And the song they're singing was about a reward notice that we'd put out asking for information on rhino poachers. They had turned that reward notice into that beautiful song. So the uptake and magnification through the communities is massive. These people are hungry for support, and we're absolutely certain we've got very fertile ground there to build on. So, yes, that component of community involvement is a major one that we intend to work on a lot more. We've already started it, but we've got a long way to go.
And, Randy, thank you for bringing that to our attention. We'll go to another caller, and that's Tom from Los Gatos. Tom, welcome. You're on.
Hey, great show, Mike. Thanks for taking my call, Michael. Sorry. The Europeans have been experiencing exotic animals, I guess, since the Roman times. And I remember Rembrandt did a charcoal sketch of an Indian elephant that was brought into Amsterdam. It was a huge sensation. And we've had, you know, giraffes you know, walk all the way from Africa to European capitals and the Renaissance as well. I was wondering, is there any possibility of using some of these captured animals that, you know, they're already enclosed, captured, and fly them to places where their horns and other body products are being made into these folk medicines to show the people there the magnificence of the animals and that they're living creatures with much more than just their medicinal value. You know, let people touch the horns and the animals and the idea that they can get their you know, healing that way rather than, you know, killing the animal and grinding up their body products or parts.
Well, it's a fair question. I have to say it's one that takes me to an area that I'm not really experienced in. I'm dealing with the field conservation issues in Africa and what might happen in Asia, particularly in terms of public relations among those communities, is not something I can say I'm an expert on. I would say, though, that a number of rhinos have been exported fairly recently from South Africa to China. We're rather concerned, though, that those rhinos, and there are well over 100 that have been moved there, may be used in a sense for rhino farming to harvest the horns to maintain this medicinal product supply. So there are a number of rhinos already across in Asia, and of course they've got their own rhinos, apart from African rhinos, that they need to be looking after across there. But in general, I'd say I'm not sure that it would work again in the time available to save these animals. Yes, we do need to do public awareness. Quite hard to do that in those cultures. I can't say I'm an expert on.
Well, Tom, thank you for the question. It also raises the perception many people have of a rhinoceros as this charging animal, you know, this animal out of control that can create havoc and render all sorts of people wounded with that horn. And so to some extent, they don't realize not only the importance of biodiversity, but also realize just how beautiful this animal is. Tom used the word magnificent, and that's the appropriate word.
Sure. I mean, I think rhinos are much more complex animals than people think. They build social structures. They maintain cohesion with each other.
They're very people-like in a lot of ways, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. I mean, just in a very touching kind of way, one thing we found, and I think it's the first time this has really been reported, because we've had to move rhinos out of areas where they're unsafe. We had to mount rescue operations and move them out. We spoke about moving rhinos from the Zambezi Valley on one side of Zimbabwe to the other side, but even within the region where I work, we've had to reorganize rhinos over the last few years, take them from one area and put them in another because of poaching flaring up. And we found when we moved those rhinos over a period of time and put them in a new area, those that knew each other in the previous area found each other again and made their linkages and connections and social bonding again. Sometimes several years after they last saw each other, they remember each other, they like each other, they all.
That's what I meant. There's almost feelings of community among rhinos.
Absolutely. I think it's a good word. It's a rhino community, no question about it.
Let me go to more of our callers. We go next to Linda. Good morning. Welcome to Forum.
Good morning. I was thinking perhaps some of the new technology could be made available to the local people in and have some of the same kinds of wonderful successes that have been happening in the Middle East, and that would be cell phones to track and help keep aware of the health and the number, and also make local people aware of strangers in a community like that. A poacher is either a stranger or someone who one knows may be up to no good, and the other thing would be computers, laptops, which can help bring them into the modern world. So if through the schools that you're talking about funding, perhaps we could have donations of cell phones and computers to help aid that, and maybe web pages sent out from the children with constant pictures and even Rhino Watch. We have falcon watches where we watch a falcon web and we watch their nests. Well, we could have Rhino Watch.
Of course, Linda, I know that, forgive me, I know there are going to be listeners who, when they hear cell phones, are going to say there are other problems in Africa that involve cell phones that need to be addressed. The material that is used in cell phones, for example, coming from areas of Africa where child labor is used and where...
And that's a problem that we have to address as well. But in the meantime, if it will help save in the short term, none of us are giving up our cell phones because of that.
We
should address that problem absolutely.
Well, but what you're raising here is, I think, again, going back to using native populations in a more positive way for conservation purposes. Yeah?
We'll give them the tools.
Yeah. What do you have to say about that, René Natois?
I fully appreciate that we need to find ways for communities to make the link with us as the rhino custodians and inform us of what's happening. Unfortunately, I come from a country, Zimbabwe, where there just isn't cell phone coverage in many of these rural areas. There are no cell phone masks. You can give as many cell phones as you want to the schools, but, you know, there's no system. Laptops, fine, but there's no power supplies. You know, we're talking about a significant step down in terms of technology from, I think, what people here might be used to, and there is a limit. At the same time, though, the bottom line really is how to create the incentives for people to communicate in whatever way they can communicate. I mean, people will walk quite a long way to bring you a message that there's rhino poachers in the area, even if they haven't got a cell phone. But we need to reward them for that. We need to provide the incentives. That's probably our most crucial step.
And let me thank the caller. Do you do a lot of this kind of public educating? Is that part of what you see your mission as?
Absolutely. What we find is that there may be a belief that the local people are living with wildlife, but actually they're often hard-edged situations. The wildlife is in a fenced area. The local communities are living in a communal land nearby. It's often fairly overpopulated. Africa doesn't have as much space as people might believe. There's increasing compression of wildlife, and that means as well that there's some distance sometimes between communities and the wildlife. Some of the people have never even seen a rhino. So a lot of our effort is just to make them more aware and actually proud of rhinos in their areas. But to do that, we have to make a lot of effort to bring them in more contact with rhinos in a meaningful, education-orientated kind of way.
What about working with some of the – well, for example, I've done a few benefits for Conservation International. There's the Wildlife Fund. I mean, there's some organizations that really have some teeth to them and have a good deal of funding. Have you joined partnerships?
Sure. We do get a lot of support. Most of our funding support comes from the International Rhino Foundation, which is based here in the U.S. WWF, World Wildlife Fund, also give us some funding support. I have to say, though, that there has been a kind of a sense on the part of the international conservation community that Zimbabwe is a bit of a lost case. A lot more money.
Because of the present government.
Because of the economic and political problems in the country.
It's unfortunate, isn't it? How would you convince them otherwise?
Well, because we've had a better rate of calf production than any other country with the resources that we've got. In other words, for every dollar spent, we've done better in terms of producing rhino calves than any other country in Africa at the moment. So we just get on with the job.
Obvious question in many ways, but maybe not. Under the Rhodesian government that preceded Zimbabwe, was there more conservation-minded concern? Was there more really resources allotted to conservation than the present government?
That would be true. The reasons for that, of course, one can debate whether they're right or wrong. But fundamentally, yes, there was a very strong conservation ethic that permeated through the Rhodesian society. It wasn't as rooted as it needed to be in the black rural societies, and that was the big challenge to face. Under the Rhodesian government, though, there was a start towards community-based conservation programs, and then with the international aid that came into Zimbabwe after independence, those were amplified. So we had quite a lot to work on. Unfortunately, though, the political kind of situation in the country meant that people ended up coming back to a situation where they had no jobs. There was much more urgent priorities of survival for them to deal with than conservation. So fundamentally, as in any society in the world, it's a question of, you know, have you got the time, have you got the money to indulge in conservation, or are you just struggling for existence to the point that, you know, wild animals are far less important than your children are?
Well, here's an important final question from Carlos, who wants to know, well, how we can help here in the Bay Area. Go ahead, Carlos.
Hi, I would like to ask the poll, because I see a lot of people suggesting, probably exposed for the first time to this issue. But what Raul has to say, or people can help, what are they, very important for people to help.
It's an important question, and thank you for it. What can people do here, people listening?
Well, there are actually more things than one might realize. One is you've got a lot of Asian communities here in this area. I mentioned earlier, I'm not an expert on Asia. There are people here who could be far better experts. And that whole question of what's happening in the trade and the dynamics could maybe be investigated through people here who can link with their communities and understand this better.
And your website for people who want to find out more?
We've just set up a website in a bit of a hurry for this. It's lowfeltrhinotrust.org.
We'll continue the good work you're doing. And again, congratulations on the Environmental Prize from the Goldman Foundation. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated tonight at 10. Thank you for joining us today on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.